This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Tommy Tomlinson has a unique voice in more ways than one. His voice rings out loud and clear in his writing, the kind that almost landed him a Pulitzer Prize when he was crafting regular columns for the Charlotte Observer. Well, now he'll use a different voice as he launches a new podcast at WFAE.org called Southbound. It's an oral medium, and so he'll be using his speaking voice. And let me tell you, that voice is really different.
So, this is the start of a new thing. A podcast about the South, told through conversations with people who grew up here, live here, and have spent time thinking about how this place shapes who they are and what they do. As your host, I'm going to be talking with notable Southerners from all walks of life. I think of the word Southbound in two
No
ways.
Question, that voice is different and not one you'd expect to hear on radio or on a podcast, but give Tommy a moment to start talking to his guests, and you will be hooked. So this hour, just before Southbound drops, as we say about podcasts that are about to be released, we're going to spend an hour talking to the notable Southerner who will be hosting so many other notable Southerners in the weeks and months to come. Tommy Tomlinson, welcome back to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
As you can tell from the reaction, we're coming to you from our studio at Spirit Square. No. We're at the Broken Spoke. It's a Sunday afternoon. Everybody's had a few, so it's all up to you, Tommy. Whose idea was this podcast? Whose idea was it to bring you to this medium?
Well, I've been thinking for a while about trying to do something with a podcast. I have often thought that, as I've written stories over the years, especially longer stories, where I got to interview somebody for an extended period of time, I often would go away thinking, man, I wish somebody could just listen to this interview. Because my job used to be I would go sort of distill that interview into something that I would write. Excuse me, for print, but I thought, what if people just heard the whole thing? And then as I started being a podcast listener and thinking about what people were doing out there, there are a lot of great interview podcasts, the main one obviously being Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and then what you've done here locally. And I thought, well, why can't we just do something like that with this frame of interesting Southerners? I mean, that was the other part of it to me, was figuring out what niche I might be able to fill. And so I thought about that, you know, as somebody who's lived here my whole life. And so I kind of thought of Southbound one day. That word just sort of stuck in my head. And as I've been talking with Joe Connor from WFAE for a while, I kind of pitched him that idea, and then we've gone from there.
How many of you in this audience here subscribe to podcasts and listen to podcasts on a regular basis? Wow. You're going to kill radio single-handedly, you know? The great thing about podcasts, and particularly podcasts like yours is going to be with these long-form conversations, is that it's kind of like reading an article. If you miss something or you need to go back over something, you can hit the rewind button, something you can't do on radio.
Sure, you can listen to it. You can rewind. You can listen to it anytime you want.
Yeah.
And I think with these longer conversations, you get to more interesting places. You know, I often thought, as I've written stories, that a lot of times the more interesting stuff got to happen when people got a little more comfortable. When you've kind of gone past the, who are you, how are you doing, you know, the icebreaker kind of stuff, yeah. And it got extended for a while, it got a little more interesting, and that's what I hope in this podcast is that we get to those interesting places.
You know what I've found on this program is that the best part of the conversation happens when the show is over. And seriously, and the guests linger. So I would tell you, when the podcast is over, don't stop recording.
No, I've heard to just start recording when somebody walks in,
yes.
And then leave it going for a while afterwards.
That's how Mark Maron does it.
Yeah, exactly.
As soon as you walk in, the thing is rolling.
Yeah.
So in your opening to your podcast, which I listened to 1,000 times getting ready for this.
I apologize.
No. You say that you listen, you regard the word Southbound and in two different ways. First, as a destination, and second, as a state of mind. And you talk about before we talk about that, I want to talk about what a lot of people who are not from the South may see as a preoccupation with the South by people who are Southerners. What is that all about? I mean, you lived for, I think, a year in Boston.
Sure.
Do people in the Northeast, in New England, do they dwell on being New Englanders? Do people in the Midwest or the Southwest think about what it's like to be a Midwesterner all the time? Because we seem to dwell on that.
I think they do, especially when we're talking to people from another place.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in Boston, people are proud of their New England roots. And, you know, my wife was from Wisconsin. Her family is really proud of their Midwestern roots. And I think people do have these little cultural things, accents, things you eat or listen to or experience that are yours. And I think people do sort of cling to those and are proud of those things. In the South, I think the difference is that this has been the site of so much turmoil in our country over the years. You know, this is where, you know, most of the slaves who ended up on plantations in the world, they came through Charleston and New Orleans and places like that. This is why the Civil War was fought, is because people here seceded from the Union. And those lingering feelings and resentments and those sort of things are part of it. But also, I think, a great pride in the way that Southerners have, you know, I don't know what the right word is, endured all these things and made it through with some of the cultural things that are good and some of the things that we should be proud of still intact.
To the rest of the country, the South is probably the South. It's a collective. It's a homogenous. But we are far from homogenous. You grew up in Alabama. This is North Carolina. North Carolina, in the Civil War, a lot of people, I think, didn't want to leave the Union. They didn't want any part of that. So we're very different people, and we're living in a time right now where the country is very conflicted. Do you think if we understood the South better, we would understand ourselves better?
Well, sure. First of all, Mike, I grew up in Georgia.
Which I'm sorry.
Which is, you know, I have...
Wait a minute.
I know. I have friends here who went to Auburn, and Auburn killed my University of Georgia. On the football field yesterday, and so I felt like, just as like a, you know, acknowledgement of that moment, I should say something there. To your question, yeah, I mean, certainly it would do us all good to understand one another better. And I think inside the South, it would do us good to understand one another better. There are pockets of very different types of people all through the South. You know, I always say that I've lived here long enough where I can sort of tell an East Tennessee accent from a West Tennessee accent, from an Alabama accent, from a South Carolina accent. But beyond that, all those people are different, and they come from different cultures and traditions. We share some things, but not everything. Mm. And so I think if people understood that this is a very diverse place in and of itself, and that would be helpful, and that's part of what I hope we do.
Yes, you said that with this podcast, you want an opportunity to explore the things that tie us to this place. Is this a quest for the listener or for you?
Oh, God, both. I mean, I certainly have always thought about and, you know, considered what keeps me here and what draws me here. You know, I don't want to live anywhere else. I've been other places. I like them just fine. I love visiting them, but this is home. But if you go one step beyond that and say, why is that? It's more for me than it's just where most of my family lives.
Yeah.
It's also, it just feels right to be here, despite all the things that I'm not proud of about the South. And so I want to parse all that out. I want to try to make sense of it. I want to try to process it. And this is, you know, it's a lifetime pursuit. I don't expect to have figured it out, you know, at any point. And I don't think people who live here have got it figured out. And certainly people who look at us from afar don't have it figured out. And so what I would like to do is just keep having these conversations and maybe glean one little bit of wisdom or two out of every conversation and cumulatively maybe make a little bit better sense of this place.
As I said a minute ago, you were raised in Georgia.
Yeah. I misheard that.
And you killed the joke, because I was going to say you were raised in Alabama with a banjo on your knee, but clearly that's not true.
See, that joke was not worth having anyway.
No, it wasn't. You have a future in this business. I don't know what it is, but you have one. Anyway, you've lived here for 30 years, and except for that 1 year that you spent in Boston, mm-hmm. this is the farthest north that you have ever lived. I'm just curious, from that time in New England, what was it about that place that struck you as substantially different from the South? Don't say clam chowder.
Well, I was going to say lobsters are incredibly cheap there. Oh, man, yeah, that $4 lobster is pretty amazing. Well, that's a good question.
Did it feel like a foreign country to you?
No, not at all. And in fact, as part of this program that I was at in Boston, there were people from all over the world there. Mm-hmm. And the one thing you found out pretty quickly is that despite all the sort of differences in particulars, that we were all pretty much the same. You know, I've always thought as a writer, there are only like five or six stories. You know, people fall in love, they fall out of love, they experience loss, they try to search for some higher meaning in the world, you know, that sort of thing. Those stories, it doesn't matter where you live or where you're from, those sort of common themes are with all of us. And so I think, you know, where you're from and what your accent is in some ways just sort of details. Now, I think the South's details happen to be really interesting, mm-hmm. or I wouldn't be doing this. But you know, living in New England for a year just told me everybody's kind of the same. They just say things differently than we do, and they root for different ball teams and, you know, and stuff like that. But I don't consider myself in any way from a different world from somebody in Boston, or for that matter, somebody from Bogota.
But did they see you that way? Because when you look at Hollywood portrayals of the South, we're kind of dumb, quaint, odd. What did they want to know from you about the South?
Well, I don't remember them wanting to know. Like, nobody wanted to know, like, do you really marry your cousins? You know, any of that sort of thing. Nobody asked. If they wanted to know, they didn't ask me about it. But I think people look at us as generally a little more conservative than the rest of the country. Generally a little more, we've had a harder time dealing with things like race than the rest of the country. And people wanted to kind of talk about some of those things. And we did talk about some of those things. One thing I found out was, certainly in those parts of the world, they have the same kind of issues we have. Mm.
Tommy Tomlinson's brand new podcast, Southbound, drops, as we say, tomorrow. That would be Wednesday. We're having a conversation with him about that from the Broken Spoke, which is in South End, for those of you who are not exactly sure where we are. And we'll come back and talk more about this in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks continues in a moment on 90.7 WFAE. Our support comes from WFAE members and NC Warren, presenting Clean Path 2025, a strategy to slow climate change, save money, and create jobs with local solar power and battery storage. ncwarren.org. And the Southern Christmas Show, now through November 19th at the Park Expo and Conference Center, celebrating their silver and gold 50th anniversary with an entrance that looks down memory lane. Tickets at southernchristmasshow.com. Tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, the tug of war over Confederate monuments. In a joint broadcast with UNC TV, Deborah Holt and Mike Collins will talk to people on all sides of the issues about critical questions surrounding these historical artifacts and what should happen to them. Experts, advocates, activists, and ordinary citizens share their views on the place, purpose, and relevance of these memorials, as well as their history, what the law says about them, and more. That's tomorrow on Charlotte Talks at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point at the UN Climate Change Conference in Bonn, Team Trump is promoting fossil fuels. The U.S. alone not in the Paris Agreement. Where does this go? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Tommy Tomlinson about his new podcast, which starts tomorrow. It's called Southbound. Southbound. That was kind of southern, wasn't it? And you can get it on iTunes. You can also get it through our website at WFAE.org. And in this podcast, you, Tommy, are going to explore stories with people through conversations. And I'm curious about your approach to that. What's the difference between a conversation and an interview?
Well, I think what people's impression of interviews is, you know, when you see like movies about journalism and that sort of thing, it's this idea of somebody with a legal pad and a list of 100 questions, and they're just going to rattle them off, and it's more like an interrogation. And I did that when I started out as a newspaper reporter because I was afraid I would forget something. But over the years, I've made it, or tried to make my interviews much more like normal conversations. I might have a couple of topics in mind that I want to talk to somebody about, but we'll start out just talking like you and I are sitting here, mm-hmm. and we're maybe have a drink or we're having a cup of coffee or something, and I just want to learn about this person that I might know a little bit about, but would like to know more about. And we have that conversation. And then along the way, I want to get into some areas like, you know, somebody might be there for a particular reason because they're known for a certain thing or they've got a new book out or something like that. We'll talk about those things eventually. But first, I just want to have a human-to-human conversation. And that's, I guess, what I think of as a difference.
And you've said you want to get beyond that first impression that people have for one another. You say, I found that the more you talk to someone, the more they become who they really are. And that's certainly probably true in a normal conversation because they begin to drop their guard, they learn more about you, etc. But this isn't, as you will soon find out if you haven't already, this, what we're doing right now, is artificial. I mean, there are people watching us. We're on these microphones. It's loud in here. People are obviously eavesdropping on our conversation. And you know this. And you know, as you're talking to these people for your podcast, that they are also going to be heard eventually beyond your ears. So how does that impact the conversation and what you're going to get out of them?
Well, I've done this for a long time. I mean, in that sense, every conversation I've had as a reporter for 30 years mm-hmm. has been artificial. Because it's not just I'm trying to get to know you better as a human being. It's I'm trying to get to know you better as a human being for this larger purpose of this story I'm doing or whatever. And what I've come to believe, you know, there's that term in movies and books that call it like suspension of disbelief. When you forget you're reading a book, you forget you're watching a movie. I like to try to have the kind of conversations where after a while, maybe you forget you're doing an interview.
Yeah.
And it takes a little time to get there usually, and you don't always. But I do find that every time you come into one of these, as you say, artificial conversations, everybody else comes into it with being not quite themselves. Either they're really trying to please you in some way, or they might be trying to antagonize you in some way.
Or they're guarded.
Mm-hmm. Or they have something they want to promote, and they want to make sure and get that out, or whatever it is. You have to talk to people for a little while to get past all that.
Yeah.
And I've come to believe through experience that once you spend enough time with somebody, they eventually have to become themselves.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this format is long enough for that to happen. We're going to try and see. But I do like kind of what we've done so far in a sense of maybe getting to people beyond what you might normally hear in an interview.
Well, a podcast, I mean, this show has to start at a certain time, and it has to end at a certain time, and we have to take breaks at certain times. So that superimposes an artificiality on it. But a podcast can be whatever it is. I mean, it can be longer than an hour. It can be 45 minutes. It can be longer than an hour, even if they say keep it to 55 minutes. You can edit stuff out.
Right.
Is that what you plan to do? Is that what you've done in the first three episodes so far?
I think the first three we've done are around an hour each.
Mm-hmm. Because that was enough?
I felt like with each one, there is, I do feel like in these conversations, there's sort of a natural stopping point. You come to some place where you feel like, you know, that was a pretty good conversation.
Mm-hmm. I feel that at 9:15 a lot.
Yeah, I know. I feel you, buddy. But I think at some point, you get to a point where we could talk for another hour and maybe get somewhere else, but it might be kind of diminishing returns.
Yeah.
And I don't want to waste people's time. And so we're starting out in my head, me and Nick Della Canal, who's the producer for the show, we've talked about it being like an hour. Mm-hmm. And I kind of look at the clock and, you know, it might be an hour and five, might be 55 minutes or something. But right when it gets to an hour, it's like we probably should sort of wind it down a little bit. But if it feels really good, I'm going to keep going.
Yeah.
And then we'll see what to do with it after that. But, yeah, that is a big advantage. Your job is much harder than my job. I get to talk however I want to talk, and then we edit it when we're done. You're on the button live.
Well, I'm kind of fascinated with the fact that you say, as a reporter, you used to go in with a notebook full of questions, and you don't plan to do that with this, that you're just, there are a couple of areas that you're interested in, and you'll let the conversation go down that path, which is exactly how I approach this, except I come in with a list of questions that I want to ask, because I want to make sure that I ask those questions. So do you prepare at all? I mean, nothing? Or are you Larry King, who said, who's on the show, and he did it?
No, God, oh. No, I think Larry King's one of a kind in many ways.
All right, Carla, you're next.
Yeah. Houston, hello. I do research, reading, look at other interviews people have done, you know, things that they've written or said, or music that they've done, if it's that sort of thing. And then I just sort of try to absorb all that and think, you know, if I ran into this person, you know, like we're at the airport and we happen to be next to each other in the seats, what would we talk about?
Yeah.
What would I ask them? Or if, you know, we ran into them at Starbucks and we're in line together, what would we talk about? That's what I wanted, you know, with the knowledge that it's a show and there is, as you said, a degree of sheen on it that's not a part of that conversation. I want it to be as much like that as possible.
So the first three people that you're talking to in the first three episodes are people that I've talked to. Harvey Gantt, Dolph Ramsor, who's a record producer who found the Avett Brothers, and I'm going to have to find it in my notes, John T. Edge,
yep,
who is a food writer. I've talked to all three of these people, and I listened to your three interviews. And what I liked about it, of course, these people were on our show to talk about specific things. You're talking to them about them specifically, which is the difference, I think.
Right.
And you talked to Harvey Gantt about a lot of different things, but one of the things you brought up is something we've never talked about, and that was a commercial that ran from the Jesse Helms campaign when he was running against Jesse Helms for the United States Senate. Remind me about that ad. Tell us about that ad.
Well, it's famously known in political circles as the Hands ad. So Harvey Gantt was winning in his race against Jesse Helms. I think this was 1990, if I remember right. And about a week or 10 days before the election, Jesse Helms put out this TV ad. And all you saw in the ad was a white hand reaching out and balling up a piece of paper. And the voiceover said, you were supposed to get this job, but they gave it to a minority instead. And then it talked about racial quotas, which was one of the big issues in the campaign. Harvey, I don't remember the numbers on this, but the day that ad came out, Harvey went from being like up 5 points to down 5 points.
Yeah.
Like that ad moved the election completely. And it changed sort of the face of history in a lot of ways.
For newcomers to Charlotte and North Carolina, Harvey Gantz, a former Charlotte mayor, he was the first black student at Clemson University, and he kind of broke the color code. You can applaud. That's great. And he told you that that ad by Jesse Helms was a genius ad, and then he told you why.
The reason it's a genius ad, in my opinion, we had downplayed the issue of race as much as you could, and people were watching and seeing white North Carolinians being neutralized by the race we had run up to that point and saying, I'm not even going to go to the polls, to folks actually beginning to believe the message that education, healthcare, and other were really the important issues. A lot of his voters were not going to vote. And they were galvanized because now this was Jesse that they knew. And Jesse was saying that those folks are coming to take your jobs. He appealed to the fear that they had that they might be losing jobs, and they were losing jobs. Textile industry is on decline, tobacco, all these things were going down. But they weren't going down because of quotas. But he'd appeal and had that effectively done and injected a little bit of race into that. Not a little bit, quite a bit of it.
Sure.
Which he could not talk about in a confrontational way with me. Might have even done more of that if Jim Hunt was running. But he couldn't with me and not end up really looking bad. But this was a way to inject it, and to inject it in the last 10 days of the campaign. And I think it turned out the voters that he needed.
So Harvey Gantz is the first episode. Was he the first person you talked to for this series?
No, I think I talked to him second or third. I talked to Dolph Ramser first. And then talked to Harvey at the Spirit Square Studios uptown.
So you're the one that changed all my knobs.
Nick, I am not allowed to even touch the knobs. So
stay away from those knobs. Yeah, you want to be near those knobs. You don't know where they've been.
Exactly.
All right. How are you choosing the people you're talking to?
Well, I think the first thing I should say about that is we have three guys leading off. And that's because they were the three that we can make arrangements to get done. We intend, and I promise, to be diverse, gender, racially, politically, lots of different ways. So it just happened to kind of fall that we have three dudes to start out with, but we will fix that. So beyond that, I'm looking for two things. I want somebody who's sort of born and raised here, or at least grew up here, and has something Southern about their work or what they do. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I want somebody who's a good talker.
Yeah.
Harvey is fantastic.
Yes, he is.
You know, my job in that interview was basically to say, so tell me how things are going, what's your life been like? And then he just talked for an hour, you know?
So tell me how things have been going. What's your life been like?
Very good. So I'd like to speak for an hour now. Things are going pretty good. I'm here, man. There are people eating barbecue and drinking and having a good time. So, well, yeah.
These people all obviously are either close personal friends of yours or they read you in the Charlotte Observer, and your columns in the Charlotte Observer were the best thing about the Observer at the time they ran.
Thank you, Mike.
They were remarkable columns, and I actually thought that you wrote those columns far longer than you actually did. And I remember being bereft when you left because I thought this is a unique voice that there is nothing like that I'd ever read before. I mean, you are remarkably talented as a writer.
Well, thank you.
And insightful. And where did that come from in you? Let's talk about, you grew up, as I said, in Georgia. Where in Georgia, brothers, sisters, who are your mother and father? What did they do?
Sure. So I have one brother and one sister who are much older. My sister died a couple of years ago. My brother's still around.
And what does he do?
He is a retired insurance agent. But before that, he was a great baseball player. He was got drafted by the Baltimore Orioles.
Wow.
Out of high school. Did not end up playing in the pros, but was an excellent. I think I still have a broken toe from his curveball from like 1976 or whatever. My mom and dad met at a seafood packing plant on St. Simons Island, Georgia. That's where they met. But they had both grown up as sharecroppers. They picked cotton for somebody else's farms. Grew up in rural Georgia in the Depression. My mom quit school in the fourth grade. My dad quit school in the sixth grade. They had to work in the fields. And my mom, when she was 12, basically had to take over her household because her mother was sick. But despite all that, they grew up with a real love of reading. So my dad, who's passed away now, had two sacred texts, the Bible and the Bass Pro Shops catalog. And my mom, to this day, reads romance novels literally by the bag load. Like, she'll get a bag, and I'll take them to the bookstore and get a new bag and fill them up. And so she reads. And so in my house, it was always reading. And a huge moment in our day was when the newspaper came. It was an afternoon newspaper, the Brunswick News. Came around 3:30 in the afternoon. I would hear it hit in our front yard. And I'd run out and get it. I would take the green rubber band off the newspaper and split it into sections, and me and my mom and dad would read the sections. And so from the time I was old enough to read, I was reading the newspaper every day.
Is that why you got into the business? Because obviously that was important in your house, therefore something important to do in life.
I went a long, circuitous route around it. I mean, I feel silly now for saying this, but it took me a long time to figure it out. I'd always loved to write. I was really curious about the world. And if you love to write and you're curious about the world, there's nothing better than journalism. But it took me a while to figure it out. I went to the University of Georgia, and as I tell people, I majored in beer for a couple of years. I would always put pre-law on my applications, but I knew I just didn't want to wear a suit, so a lawyer was not for me. But when I was a junior in college, I went to an open tryout for the Red and Black, which was the University of Georgia's campus newspaper.
Right.
And I wrote like two stories, and that was it. I knew immediately.
Why? What was it about writing those two stories?
I liked going and talking to strangers with a purpose. I am naturally introverted. I'm not good at parties. Anybody who's tried to talk to me tonight before this thing knows I'm sort of awkward, and I'm the kind of guy who at a party ends up in the corner looking at the books. I'm that guy. But being a journalist gives you a ticket to talk to people and do those sorts of things, and it gives you permission to get out on the dance floor and do that sort of thing. And so it was a great fit for me.
Tommy Tomlinson is our guest. His new podcast, Southbound, starts tomorrow at WFAE.org and on iTunes. When we come back, we talk about the elephant in the room. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
More Charlotte Talks in just a moment on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Our support comes from WFAE members and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. And Nexen Pruitt, over 190 lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court and at the deal table from Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point, at the UN Climate Change Conference in Bonn, the U.S. delegation is promoting fossil fuels. The United States now stands alone, the world's only country not in the Paris Agreement. The discussion on where this may lead, coming up on Point at 10, here on 90.7 WFAE.
First, the diagnosis, anorexia nervosa. Then intensive treatment. Now the daily struggle of recovery.
Even when I'm doing better, it's like there's chained to my ankle a dead body, and it's there all the time.
For our series Been There, two women compare notes on fighting an eating disorder this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming from the Broken Spoke early on a Sunday evening, even though it's a Tuesday morning when you're hearing this. And Tommy is here because his Southbound podcast starts tomorrow on WFAE.org and on iTunes. Not even I can say that. I just 40 years in this business, and I can't say that. One of the things that you have already always done incredibly well, first through writing and now through these conversations, is eliciting and telling stories and profiles of other people. And you say that you were probably the worst storyteller in your family. How can that be? Who was better?
Everybody was better. I mean, we used to sit around. You asked where that sort of storytelling spark came from. For me, it came from family reunions. We would go to my Uncle Ted and Aunt Estelle's house in a little town called Nahanna, Georgia, which was once home to the World Armadillo Festival. We all our relatives would come from all over the country, and we would have supper, which was this incredible, you know, Southern feast. And at the end, you know, we unfortunately, sort of traditionally, the women would kind of clean up and they would sit around the table, and the men would go outside, usually stand around a pickup truck or something with day's work, chewing tobacco, maybe a little flask passed around, and everybody would tell stories. And so as a kid, I had a ticket to both worlds. So I would go, like, get under the table and listen to the women talk, and then I would go outside and listen to the men talk. And they would tell the same stories, often with different heroes and villains, depending on who was telling the story, but they would tell the same kind of stories. And they were all born into that Southern tradition of just sitting around the porch and just everybody sort of swapping stories. Hmm. And they were all great at it. And that's where whatever storytelling, you know, gifts I've been given, that's where they come from.
And a lot of storytelling takes place around a table where there's food being
sure.
served. And one of the people you're talking to in one of your episodes is John T. Edge. He's a writer. He's a commentator. He's the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance at an institute of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi. It's all about Southern food. And in this clip, he talks about the evolution of his boyhood favorite shrimp and grits.
Yeah, that's a pretty typical pattern for a provincial dish, a working class dish, which is essential and delicious, that is adopted by the middle class and transformed by way of, you know, plating or garnish or even setting, putting it in a restaurant as opposed to a home table or kitchen table. That's kind of the way cuisines evolve, the best of them. And that's kind of at the root of Southern food, is that this is home cooking, and the dishes that now show up on fine dining tables in a place like Highlands Bar and Grill in Birmingham, which is arguably kind of the signal new Southern restaurant interpreter, the dishes served there in a grand setting with great circumstance are rooted in farm traditions and working class traditions of the South. That's what makes them resonant, I think.
So if you're talking about the South, you have to talk about the food, because our food is unique and we're known for our food, and the ingredients in that food is like bacon grease and fat back and fried chicken and hush puppies. And I use that as an awkward stepping off point to talk about your first book, The Elephant in the Room, which is about life as an overweight man in a growing America, which is soon to be published by Simon & Schuster. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That seems to be, I think, a difficult thing to write about, especially when it's about you. Why did you take that on?
Because you write what you know, and this is what I know more than anything. I know about what it's like to be a fat kid and a fat teenager and a fat you know, adult and now a fat middle-aged man. And you know, what you hear from other people, how other people deal with you, how you deal with the, you know, the outside world. Like, I was just, you know, people who know me know this. These kind of settings, like a crowded restaurant or a bar or something, are a little uncomfortable for me sometimes, because I always wonder, how am I going to get from one end of the room to the other? You know, because it's there. Sometimes there are narrow spaces, or I have to like kind of shove somebody out of the way a little bit to get past them. So I'm always considering, as I'm trying to enjoy myself, I'm always thinking about how do I move around in this world.
So have you been overweight since you were a child?
Oh yeah, since I was.
Is it because why? Is it because you eat a lot? I mean,
Mike,
seriously,
Mike, that's a question that is taking a book to answer.
Because I worked with a guy named Henry Bogan years ago at WBT, and great man.
Henry Bogan. Yeah.
And he was overweight, and I ate with him many, many, many times and never saw him eat as much as I ate.
Right. But then he goes home.
Well, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, that's it's funny. My friends say the same thing, that when we're together, I eat what everybody else eats, but then at least in the past, when I went home, I'd stop and get something else, or when I got home, raid the ice cream or whatever. But that's the how. That's not as much. The why is a lot of things. It's, you know, how I grew up. You know, I grew up in a very blue-collar household where everybody had to work really hard with their hands and their backs and their legs. So my mom and dad, for example, well, let's just even go further back than that. When they were kids in the cotton fields, they would wolf down 4 or 5 biscuits every morning before they went on the field, and they would burn it all off.
Yep.
You know, and so they could put away platters of fried chicken and pork chops and all the southern vegetables that are enhanced. My wife always jokes about the time that when she was first cooking with my mom, and my wife said, "How is this squash so good?" And my mom said, "Well, you start with ham, you know." and so they ate all these things, and like many people in my family are pretty fit, at least the ones who stayed in blue collar jobs, because they could burn it all off.
Right.
But then I get to a world where I basically have a desk job, and I'm not burning it all off, and so that's the beginnings of it, I guess. But then you think, you know, once you figure that all out. And you're old enough to know better, what keeps you doing it? And that's, you know, a cycle of, I think, a little bit of self-loathing, a little bit of not wanting to grow up, you know, just a whole mix of different things that I try to figure out.
Is that what the book is about?
Yeah, it's about, part of it's about me trying to get in shape and how that goes. But then on top of that, is that bigger story about, you know, why is this so hard? Why is it taking me so long to get here?
There's an article, I think it's this morning, in the New York Times about Weight Watchers and how if they don't make their nut in January, they're not going to make it. Because right. January is when everybody makes their resolution to lose sure. weight and get fit. And I think it was last year they didn't make it. Because people don't want to diet anymore, they just want to be fit, and diet is out of fashion. And you say that we're living in a growing America. You may have been alone 40 years ago, but you're not now. I mean, by 2030, projections say that 44% of Americans will be obese, and I'm actually surprised it's not going to be higher. Was there a time when you felt alone because of your weight?
No, I mean, well, yes and no. Yes, in those moments where I was like literally alone, you know, I'd come home from somewhere and be by myself and try to like, you know, like everybody has something, you know, whether it's alcohol or drugs or whatever, everybody has something. Everybody has this moment where you're like, what the hell am I doing? Why is this still a problem for me? And in those moments, I did feel alone and lonely because I couldn't figure out how to talk to other people about it well, and I couldn't figure out how to answer that very obvious question that you asked, which is why. And so this book is about trying to answer that question.
Here's the other elephant in the room, your voice.
Is there something weird about it?
No. You know, the first time we met, I think it was when you were going to be on the radio, and you started to talk before we went on the air, and I thought, oh, my God. Because I thought the listener would be uncomfortable thinking that it hurt for you to talk. It doesn't hurt to talk.
No.
But you had throat cancer.
I did.
1993?
I was 29, yeah.
Wow. Talk to me about that. How did you know to even get checked for that? What happened?
I started to get what I thought was laryngitis. And, you know, I just lost my voice. It actually sounded kind of like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just come back to the Observer after being away for a few months. I came back, I'd started working, and I couldn't talk to anybody on the phone. And I was like, okay, it's laryngitis. So I go see my doctor, and my doctor, you know, doesn't see anything obvious. He sends me to an ear, nose, and throat guy. Ear, nose, and throat guy looks down in there and says, yeah, you got a polyp. So those are almost always benign. It's no big deal. Come do outpatient surgery. We'll take it out. So I go do the outpatient surgery. My friend Zane, who's here somewhere, wheeled me out of the little clinic to take me home. And the doctor walked me out. And he said, you know, I was planning to go home for a week back to Georgia because I wasn't going to be able to talk for a while.
Right.
I wasn't going to be allowed to talk. And he said, maybe you should come back sooner rather than later. And that was obviously like in a movie you would hear like the ominous music, you know, then. And so I came back after a few days and he said, you know, we looked at this and it's malignant. And so I had a choice. After talking to several doctors with some sort of hilarious results, I went to Duke Medical Center to get a second or third opinion, and a guy stuffed a camera up my nose, and I had my head back, and he's got this thing jammed up my nose, and right at that moment, like 30 medical students walked in, and he said, oh, everybody, come look, you know, and I have my head back, and I'm like, hi, you know. So anyway, where it came down to was one doctor recommended that I get radiation treatment, and another doctor recommended that I get surgery and then radiation as a lesser radiation as a follow, excuse me, as a follow-up. The radiation, it would preserve my voice, but they weren't sure it would get all the cancer. Surgery, they could get all the cancer. They weren't sure it was going to preserve my voice. I decided to get the surgery. I was in the hospital at CMC up here for 17 days, not being able to talk, not knowing if, when it was over, if I would be able to talk. And
because the surgery involved what? Taking away part of your...
Yeah, I was certain the cancer was in my larynx, my voice box, and they had to take out about 40% of that to get everything. And so on day 17 or whatever it was, the doctor came in, they took the little patch off, and they said, so say something. And I just kind of said, hey. Yeah, I wish I had thought of, like, hello, I'm Johnny Cash. Yeah, I wish I had something smarter to say. But I was terrified because I'd spent my career, I'd staked my career on being able to talk to people, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to. And so once I knew I had a voice, I thought, I can probably make this work. And go ahead.
No.
Well, I was going to say, I think in some ways, it has turned out to be an advantage. I was never good at being the kind of person who yelled across the room in a reporting situation or any other situation, really. And having the voice that I have forces a more intimate conversation. Like if I'm in a loud room like this, and I really want to talk to somebody, I got to get them in a corner somewhere. And then we can have a conversation. And so in that way, it makes people listen to me better. And I think it also makes me a better listener. So that we're not sort of like, shouting at each other. We're just kind of, we're close. And that just sort of physical proximity makes a difference.
That will help you with this podcast. Have you found that that is the case?
Yeah, I think so. Even when we're, you know, I prefer to do stuff face-to-face.
Yeah.
But we've done at least one of these on the phone. And I think even then, somebody having to pay close attention to what I'm saying makes them pay more close attention to the conversation. Mm. At least I hope that's true.
You're eliciting stories from people, life stories from people, the stories of their lives. Why do you think stories are so important to people to hear?
It's what makes us human. It makes us different from every other creature on earth. We tell each other stories, and that's how we make sense of the world around us. You know, you tell me a story that helps me understand mm-hmm. you, and then I'll tell you a story that helps you understand me. And as we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, all the differences that we have as people, you know, regionally, politically, racially, gender-wise, all these different things that make us different are undercut by our common threads. And the only way we learn that stuff is by learning each other's stories.
Lots of stories to come from Tommy and his guests on his podcast, Southbound, which starts on Wednesday at WFAE.org and on iTunes. Tommy, best of luck. I know you'll be hosting this show sooner or later, so I'll just get out of the way. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.